This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
It's time once again for Time Magazine. Each week, we bring you stories created by a team of national correspondents, from entertainment to politics, from technology to economics. Time Magazine has it all. Coming up on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Time Magazine, and I'm your reader, Patsy, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll continue reading from the April 8th edition of Time Magazine, and I'll begin in the business section with an article titled Desert Power. The United Arab Emirates, using oil wealth and its citizens' data, is betting on AI to project influence beyond its borders, by Billy Perigo. At an AI research lab on the edges of Abu Dhabi last year, an international team of 25 computer scientists were putting the finishing touches on a deep learning algorithm before sending it to be trained on 4,000 powerful computer chips. The AI system, which cost several million dollars to train, was funded by an arm of the Abu Dhabi government called the Advanced Technology Research Council, ATRC. Despite the government's substantial investment, ATRC Secretary General Faisal Al-Banai decided to release the finished model online for free. If it was as good as the team believed, the boost to the United Arab Emirates' reputation would be all the return the government needed on its investment, he reasoned. The plan worked. When the AI, named Falcon, after the UAE's national bird, was publicly released last September, it became a sensation. By some measures, it was the best open-source large language model, LLM, available in the world at that point, outperforming top offerings from Meta and Google. Before Falcon's release, we were not on the map, says Al-Banai, but with 25 people, we did that, and it really created a surprise. Around the world, computer scientists took notice. The UAE was not well known before for training models, says Philip Schmid, an AI researcher at the machine learning platform Hugging Face, based in Germany. But then, by more or less the next day, we knew that they can train models. They open source their models. They publish research around it, which benefits all. Falcon seemed to be the first sign of the UAE's rapid rise in the world of AI. In this realm, the U.S. and China are the world's undisputed heavyweights. But sandwiched between the two superpowers, the United Arab Emirates is beginning to punch above its weight. The tiny Gulf nation of some 10 million, which appointed the world's first AI minister in 2017, is betting big on the technology as an engine for diversifying its economy away from oil and for projecting geopolitical influence beyond its borders. In recent months, some of Silicon Valley's most powerful CEOs have visited the UAE, from Microsoft's Satya Nadella to NVIDIA's Jensen Huang. But while solidifying the Emirati government's belief that it has what it takes to become an AI power, Falcon also made a larger point. If this powerful new technology is indeed to usher in a new world, it will be shaped by those with the greatest wealth and power in the one that currently exists. Emirati officials point to their advantages: huge cash reserves to pay for top-tier compute or computing hardware, enough electricity powered by oil, natural gas, and solar, not only to power that hardware, but also to make building new data centers more attractive than in Europe and other parts of Asia, where grids are battling energy bottlenecks. And though most of the 88% of the foreigners who populate the UAE toil at low-wage jobs, officials express confidence that year-round sun and the absence of income tax can attract the world's top AI researchers who are in high demand. If they come, it would be to join an effort unhindered by internal critics or other essentials of democracy. The Emirati state has spent the past two decades digitizing government services, and authorities here have a more permissive attitude than those in many Western countries to using citizens' anonymized data for training AI. In fact, the UAE casts its autocratic, state capitalist government as a plus, giving it the ability to quickly marshal its significant resources to achieve what it sees as an epochal project. What we have in the UAE that's going to give us an advantage is the decision-making power to make it happen, says Al-Banai, the official in charge of the ATRC. Yes, you need some checks and balances, but in many places it is overdone. Abu Dhabi's ruling family controls several of the world's largest sovereign wealth funds, worth a combined total of some $1.5 trillion. Those funds have historically been used as vehicles to diversify the UAE's oil wealth into growth industries, making them a perfect match for leaders of AI companies seeking the capital necessary to participate in the AI race. The country is also emerging as a player to watch in the world of difficult-to-produce computer chips used to train powerful AI systems. In February, OpenAI CEO Sam Altman met with investors seeking up to $7 trillion to build an AI chipmaker that could compete with market leader NVIDIA, the Wall Street Journal reported. Prospective investors include Sheikh Tanun bin Zayed Al Nahyan, who controls Abu Dhabi's main sovereign wealth fund and is a brother of the UAE president. If successful, the efforts would catapult the UAE to a position of outsized influence in the world of AI. The country will have competition. Saudi Arabia, its largest neighbor, is earmarking $40 billion for a push into AI, a sum that would make it one of the largest investors in the space, the New York Times reported on March 19th, citing unnamed sources. The UAE has already found itself caught in geopolitical crosswinds, especially as tensions rise between the U.S. and China over advanced semiconductors, the chips Washington is trying to keep from Beijing. It's the transfer of technology, information, and intelligence to China that the U.S. is really concerned about, says Neil Gilliam, an expert on Gulf geopolitics based at the London International Affairs think tank Chatham House. The U.S. has basically been saying to the UAE, don't go down that path. That's going to cross the line with us. At a research and development lab in Dubai on a rare rainy evening in February, the UAE's AI minister, Omar Al-Olama, sits down to discuss the nation's AI ambitions. On the other side of a glass wall separating the meeting room from the lab floor, an autonomous delivery robot designed by government-funded researchers lies dormant, the same bright white as the minister's thobe. The 34-year-old Al Olama reels off a list of ways AI could improve the quality of life in the Gulf nation, reducing road traffic, improving hospital capacity, cutting down on state bureaucracy, even creating an AI-enabled tour guide for tourists. Increasing quality of life, Al Olama insists, is the main driver of the UAE's ambitions here. Economic growth is an incentive, too. We do believe that through artificial intelligence, we'll be able to expand our economic footprint and really become one of the big players in certain domains, he says. Al Olama was just 27 when he was appointed to his role in 2017 and given the task of turning the UAE into a leading nation in AI by 2031. Omar has unique credibility as the first AI minister on the global stage, says Amandeep Singh Gill, the UN Secretary General's envoy on technology, who has worked closely with Al Olama on a UN effort to build global consensus on AI. He's very personable. Without airs, he moves in and makes friends with people. His youth is an essential part of that charisma. Al Olama has friendly relationships with diplomats and businessmen alike. Pacing the stage at the World Government Summit, WGS, in Dubai in February, he joked with Altman, who appeared on the screen behind him via video call, "I'm looking to raise $7 trillion if you're interested in joining," Al Olama said, referring in jest to headlines that had broken the previous week. "If you figure out how to do that, please let me know," Altman replied with a smile. "I'd be very curious." WGS, where Al Olama is vice chair, is a media and event partner of Time. Offstage, Al Olama is coy about the reports that Altman had attempted to raise funds equal to almost a third of U.S. GDP from investors, including the UAE. "I'm not sure, to be honest, how real that is, the $7 trillion project. I think someone might have misquoted either Sam or the UAE government on that. $7 trillion is an audacious number, to say the least." Still, Al Olama says the UAE has the ambition to proceed in the direction of playing a bigger role in global semiconductor manufacturing. "The world," he says, "is looking for a decentralization of semiconductor production beyond Taiwan, the geopolitical flashpoint in China's backyard where most high-end chips are currently manufactured." The UAE's working with the U.S. to expand that bottleneck is going to be a win-win situation for everyone because it ensures stability, it ensures economic cohesion between the UAE and the U.S., he says. But Al Olama is most animated while discussing not hardware, but software. Falcon was released under an open-source license, and in February, the ATRC committed $300 million toward the Falcon Foundation, a nonprofit body to oversee the continued open-source development of the LLM series. The UAE's commitment to open sourcing AI has been a diplomatic success, winning it friends in global South countries that would otherwise be shut out of costly AI development. Part of the motivation is obviously finding a niche for the UAE and national competitiveness, Gill says. But the UAE is interested in helping other countries access compute, access these open source models so that they can develop AI applications in their own contexts. A big part of the thinking behind the UAE's open source commitment, according to Al Olama, is to attract top AI researchers away from lucrative jobs at Silicon Valley tech companies by giving them a sense of purpose. If you bring a person who is the top scientist in this field and you tell him you have two options, either work for profit, closed source, and just benefit yourself, or work on something that's open source that will really change the lives of people, what would you decide? Al Olama says, we realized that the attraction of talent is much better when people actually believe this is for the greater good. The number of AI workers in the UAE quadrupled to 120,000 from 2021 to 2023, Al Olama recently told Bloomberg. It is a place made out of heaven for researchers in AI, says Al Banai, the head of the Abu Dhabi government's ATRC. You have the compute, you have access to data, and you have the commitment to fund the research you're doing. There aren't many places that have all of this under one roof. But the UAE also faces challenges when attracting top researchers. For all its low taxes, sunshine, and glamour, civil liberties and internet freedoms in the UAE are subject to significant restrictions, according to Freedom House, which rates the country as not free. LGBTQ plus activity is criminalized, and labor abuses among the migrant workers brought in to support the UAE's service and construction industries are well documented. The country is not listed among the top six where most elite AI researchers work, according to an analysis by researchers at the Paulson Institute think tank. Of the 14 authors named on the Falcon research paper, 8 have LinkedIn profiles indicating that they are not based in the UAE. Are they going to be able to attract talent to move to the UAE who can make $1 million+ anywhere? Says Dylan Patel, chief analyst at SemiAnalysis, an AI industry monitor. I'm skeptical. Still, officials in Abu Dhabi, the capital, remain bullish. Al Banai says Falcon's successors will be even more powerful, and not only because the government is willing to commit more money and computing power to the effort. We have a third asset, which we have not yet utilized, he says. He is referring to private data that is not normally available on the internet, such as records held by hospitals and state-backed industries. Try to go to some countries and get access to data to train, Al Banai says. Okay, good luck. The UAE, he says, has permitted AI companies to train models on citizens' medical data stripped of names and identifying information. Similar efforts in countries like Britain have run into legal challenges and opposition in the press, just the kind of obstacles that, in the UAE, are easier to brush aside. You can either debate forever or you can move, Al Banai says. We have decided to move. Last summer, OpenAI CEO Altman traveled to the UAE as part of a global tour capitalizing on the success of ChatGPT. I am hopeful that the region can play a central role in this global conversation, he told the crowd, praising the attendees who he said had been discussing AI since before it was cool. 4 months later, the UAE's top AI firm, G42, announced a partnership with OpenAI. The companies would collaborate to deliver cutting-edge AI solutions to the UAE and regional markets, a post on G42's website said, without disclosing specifics. At the top of the page, the post was illustrated with a photograph of a smiling Altman shaking hands with G42's CEO, Peng Shao, apparently taken during Altman's trip to the Gulf earlier that summer. It was another illustrious partnership for the state-linked Emirati firm, which in 2023 signed a $100 million deal with the California company Cerebras to build what it calls the world's largest supercomputer for AI training. Shortly after G42 announced its partnership with OpenAI, geopolitical tensions burst into the open. In November, the New York Times published a report detailing concerns within the U.S. intelligence agencies about G42's ties to China. National security officials, the report said, were concerned that advanced American technologies and sensitive data of U.S. citizens could make their way to China via G42, which had relationships with Chinese companies, including Huawei. In a high-level meeting at the White House just days before Altman's trip to Abu Dhabi, the Biden administration had pushed the UAE to sever its links to Beijing, according to the Times. 2 months later, it tightened rules on chip exports to an undisclosed list of Middle Eastern countries and concerns over the chips ultimately reaching China. G42's agreement with OpenAI may have been less than it appeared. The Emirati firm had simply signed up to become one of OpenAI's many enterprise clients, according to a person with knowledge of the matter. The agreement granted G42 access to OpenAI's application programming interface, a tool that allows companies to integrate ChatGPT and GPT-4's capabilities into their own apps. G42 is not an investor in OpenAI and is bound by OpenAI's usage policies, the person added. An OpenAI spokesperson declined to comment on the record. Still, it was an example of the kind of relationships with foreign tech firms that the UAE government has long encouraged its domestic companies to enter into, according to Alexis Serfati, director of geotechnology at the political risk consultancy Eurasia Group. The idea there is to expand links into the global value chain and enable as much technology transfer as possible. In the months that followed the White House meeting, G42 began cutting its ties to China. The company said it was phasing out Huawei gear and had sold its roughly $100 million stake in ByteDance, TikTok's Chinese parent company. "We cannot work with both sides," Peng told the FT. G42 did not respond to requests for comment. Today, Emirati officials are keen to stress their closeness to Washington. "The UAE has been a strategic partner to the U.S. since our founding. We've gone through a lot," says Al-Olama. According to Serfati, the UAE moved quickly to distance its tech industry from China's because officials considered it crucial to retain access to the high-end semiconductors subject to American sanctions. "Even if the UAE is uncomfortable removing themselves from Chinese hardware, ultimately, they want to ensure access to U.S. chips." When it comes to building new semiconductor factories, Altman has not denied that he is seeking funds for a new chip-making venture. But he has urged skepticism of the $7 trillion price tag reported by the journal. "You shouldn't believe everything you read in the press," Altman said at an event on February 21st. The kernel of truth is that we do think investing a lot of money in AI, compute, energy, and data centers is going to be important to deliver the amount of services people want. The question is where the investment will happen. Taiwan, which dominates chip production now, is a democracy that's vulnerable to China militarily. Gulf kingdoms share China's autocratic model for governance, but historically fall in line with Washington on security. If they are able to diversify the existing supply chain, make it more resilient, that could certainly benefit the U.S., says Serfaty. On the other hand, it depends on which foreign government Altman and his partners ultimately partner with, and that could very well conflict with U.S. national security strategy. In the end, the U.S. government may have effective veto power over the UAE's ambitions. Semiconductors are at the core of the Biden administration's CHIPS and Science Act, which includes billions in incentives for the onshoring of semiconductor manufacturing to the U.S. itself. Altman has reportedly met with the U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo to seek her blessing for his project to create a NVIDIA competitor, and has reportedly said he would not proceed without U.S. government approval. The Commerce Department declined to comment. Even if the UAE does stump up the money for new semiconductor factories, those factories may end up being located on U.S. soil. Back in the government-funded R&D lab, Al Olama projects an air of confidence about the UAE's future role in the AI landscape. "We always gravitate toward ambition as a country," he says with a smile. "We are very ambitious people." This article was with reporting by Leslie Dickstein. Turn now to the brief section of the April 8th edition of Time Magazine, and an article titled "The Politics of TikTok" by Eric Cortaleza. How the Chinese platform's popularity and self-interest took Trump from ban to embrace. As Congress considers legislation that could lead to a TikTok ban, the popular platform has found an unlikely ally, Donald Trump. The former president has recently railed against a bill that would remove TikTok from U.S. app stores unless its Beijing-based parent company, ByteDance, sells its stake. To many, the move came out of left field. As president, Trump signed an executive order to ban TikTok unless an American company acquired it, alleging the Chinese government was using the video-sharing service to surveil millions of Americans. Challenged in federal court, the order never went into effect. But now Trump sees some utility in helping to keep TikTok around, especially after President Joe Biden said he would sign the new congressional bill into law. "Frankly, there are a lot of people on TikTok that love it," Trump told CNBC. "There are a lot of young kids on TikTok who will go crazy without it." Trump's flip-flop has sparked allegations that he's doing the bidding of a powerful donor with a stake in ByteDance. But part of his calculus, sources familiar with Trump's thinking tell Time, is the opportunity to make gains with younger voters by protecting a platform they love. "He realizes that a lot of people would be upset if it were banned," says a Trump operative working on the re-election effort. Now Trump and Biden are on opposite sides of an issue where younger voters are clearly in favor of not banning TikTok. Trump has other reasons for the reversal. He recently struck a rapprochement with the anti-tax group Club for Growth after it admitted defeat in an expensive effort to keep Trump from winning the nomination. We're back in love, Trump told a gathering of its donors, per Politico, soon after meeting with one of its benefactors, billionaire Jeff Yass. The group opposes the TikTok bill, mirroring the position of Yass, whose investment company owns 15% of ByteDance. To boost the effort, Club for Growth hired Trump loyalist Kellyanne Conway to advocate for TikTok on the Hill. Trump also fears the legislation would strengthen one of his nemesis, Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram. Trump resents the company's founder, Mark Zuckerberg, for donating $400 million in 2020 to help governments facilitate mail voting, a system Trump baselessly maligns as rife with fraud. Trump and his allies further accuse the company of suppressing conservative content and news stories damaging to Democrats. Zuckerberg's censorship of the Hunter Biden laptop story helped the Democrats dramatically in 2020, says Alex Brusewitz, a Trump ally and GOP consultant. Zuckerberg has said Facebook never kept users from posting about the story, but limited how much the story was amplified. Despite Trump's opposition, the TikTok bill sailed through the House on March 13th on a bipartisan 352-65 vote. But it faces an uphill climb in the Senate, even as the White House pushes for its passage. The D.C. TikTok debate is primarily focused on national security. Chinese law obliges Chinese companies to cooperate on intelligence. In 2020, Washington forced a Chinese company to sell the dating app Grindr after reports it supplied users' private data to Beijing. There are similar fears that TikTok could also be a tool for spying or propaganda. A third of U.S. adults under 30 regularly scroll TikTok for news, according to a Pew survey. Several polls show it is Gen Z's top source for news and information. Security was Trump's stated concern about the platform while president, but it's become popular among his supporters. The Nelk Boys, whose podcast Trump has appeared on twice, have 4.6 million followers on the app. Tucker Carlson has 1.3 million. The right-wing account American Wire News amassed more than 6.5 million views for a recent clip of Trump bringing on stage a supporter who had kicked out a heckler at one of his rallies. Like other social media, TikTok could mobilize the MAGA faithful. It has an extremely personalized algorithm, says Ashley Johnson, a policy analyst for the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation in Washington. It can amplify these filter bubbles we create for ourselves in terms of primarily or even only seeing political content that we agree with. An analysis by Tufts researchers that found young voters favored Biden over Trump in 2020 by a 25-point margin. But recent polls show that gap to be shrinking. An Axios Generation Lab survey of voters under 35 in February found Biden leading by just 4 percentage points. Campaign operatives think TikTok may be crucial to reaching those voters. The app, which grew by 12% from 2021 to 2023, is now used by more than 170 million Americans. That growth, members of Trump's inner circle say, helps explain why he is now defending it. TikTok is more relevant now than when that executive order was written, says the Trump operative. Some Trump allies expect him to turn it into a campaign wedge issue. This is Biden's ban now, says Brusewitz, and tens of millions of young voters know it. And now a brief article on happiness in the U.S., a new low. For the first time in the 12-year history of the World Happiness Report, the U.S. did not rank in the top 20 of the world's happiest countries. Of the more than 140 nations surveyed, the U.S. came in 23rd, compared with 15th in 2023. While the U.S. is still in the top 10 happiest countries for people 60 and older, its overall ranking fell because of a significant decline in the reported well-being of Americans under 30. Finland ranked at the top of the list for the seventh year in a row. Lithuania is the happiest country in the world if you look only at those under the age of 30, while Denmark is the happiest country for those 60 and older. This was the first year the report, released March 20th, analyzed rates of happiness by age group, said John F. Helliwell, professor at the Vancouver School of Economics and founding editor of the report. There is a great variety among countries in the relative happiness of the younger, older, and in-between populations. Fighting to Free Russia's Political Prisoners by Jasmin Serhan. Vladimir Putin's presidential victory this March was more of a coronation than an election. With the political system heavily skewed in his favor and all significant opponents disqualified, jailed, or dead, the vote was almost entirely pro forma. Still, the Russian opposition lives on, not just in would-be leaders behind bars like Vladimir Kara-Murza, who, following the death of Alexei Navalny, is now Russia's most high-profile political prisoner, but also in the spouses who take up their advocacy when they're no longer able to do it themselves. Ever since Vladimir's arrest in April 2022 for criticizing the war in Ukraine, Evgenia Kara-Murza has spent most of her days traveling the world to meet with foreign dignitaries, testify before committees, and talk to journalists, all in a bid to bring her husband and the scores of other political prisoners in Russia home. When time first sat down with her on the sidelines of the 15th annual Geneva Summit for Human Rights and Democracy last year, she stressed that she was no politician. "I never wanted to be a public figure," she said. Yet there she was, delivering speeches and giving interviews about the plight of political prisoners, the importance of supporting Ukraine against Russia's ongoing invasion, and the need for Magnitsky's sanctions, which target officials who violate human rights. She basically stepped into his shoes and took over from his work as a member of the Russian opposition, speaking not just about his situation, but about the situation of other political prisoners, says Bill Browder, a British-American anti-corruption campaigner and close friend of the Kara-Murza family. She feels it's her duty to be the best possible representative of him when he's unable to represent himself. Born on the Kuril Islands in Russia's Far East, Evgenia spent much of her childhood traveling around the Soviet Union. Her father was in the Coast Guard. It was after her family settled in Moscow that, at the age of 11, she first met Vladimir. Though at 14, Vladimir moved with his mother to Britain while Evgenia remained in Russia, pursuing a degree at Moscow State Linguistic University, they reconnected in their 20s and have been together ever since. Evgenia says she's always supported her husband's pro-democracy work, even as the space for him to do it within Russia began to shrink. In 2003, Vladimir stood in Russia's parliamentary elections, a contest that, while ostensibly free, was far from fair, resulting in a victory for the ruling United Russia Party. The following year, they moved to Washington, D.C., where Vladimir became the bureau chief for the independent Russian broadcaster RTVI. During their years in the U.S., the political situation in Russia continued to deteriorate. It became apparent that if Vladimir were to continue with his work as he saw fit, the kids needed to be in a safe place, she says. So I mostly stayed with the kids working from home, and Vladimir traveled the world, trying to bring change to open the world's eyes to the nature of Vladimir Putin's regime. But it wouldn't be long before Vladimir faced the consequences of his activism. In May 2015, he was poisoned for the first time. The second came 2 years later. In both cases, he fell into a coma. Both times, Evgenia nursed him back to health, helping him relearn how to walk, to talk, and even how to eat. "I believe this is what marriage is about," Evgenia told Time in Geneva. "You share everything and you're there for each other. That's the only way to me." Evgenia isn't the only spouse who has come to politics in this way. In the aftermath of Navalny's death, his wife, Yulia Navalnaya, vowed to take up his fight. Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya, the leader of Belarus' exiled opposition, challenged Belarusia dictator Alexander Lukashenko for the country's presidency in the place of her husband, the jailed pro-democracy activist Sharhehi Tsikhanouskaya. All three women represent an increasingly pronounced feminine face of anti-Kremlin activism, one that has emerged within a political culture in which politicians' wives are rarely seen, much less heard. The circumstances notwithstanding, Evgenia welcomes this change, but she also stresses that there are others, including ethnic minorities and members of the LGBTQ community, who are changing the face of the pro-democracy and anti-war movements in Russia. "It's becoming so diverse, and it's interesting that it's happening under these impossible circumstances." If Evgenia fears for her or her family's safety, she doesn't show it. She speaks with a cool-headed resolve, the kind that Browder attributes to the justness of her cause and her being, just a really decent human being. It's perhaps because that cause is bigger than just her husband and her family that Evgenia never comes across as a worried spouse. The last thing she wants is pity. "I hate condolences and expressions of sympathy because that's not what I need," she says. "I need action." When asked where she gets her strength, Evgenia quotes Eleanor Roosevelt, "A woman is like a tea bag. You never know how strong she is until she's in hot water." This April will mark 2 years since Vladimir's arrest and 2 years since Evgenia was plunged into her current role. The longer she's in it, the stronger she seems to get, and the angrier, too. "That rage that I feel because this murderous government has been trying to destroy my family for so many years is currently trying to destroy the neighboring country and all chances for a normal future for our country. That rage," she says, before letting out a deep exhale. "A woman is like a teabag." And now from the health section. The 5-Minute Quiz That Helped Catch Olivia Munn's Cancer by Alice Park. Actor Olivia Munn recently shared in an Instagram post that a free risk assessment tool her doctor used revealed that she had a higher chance of developing breast cancer. It led to testing and eventually treatment that likely spared her from more serious outcomes. The breast cancer risk assessment tool isn't new. It's been around since 1989 for women ages 35 to 74, and it doesn't even require a doctor. The online questionnaire available through the National Cancer Institute, NCI, asks about a woman's age, her family history of breast cancer, when she began menstruating, how old she was when she had her first child, if applicable, and if she's had any breast biopsies. It then estimates her risk of getting breast cancer in 5 years and over the course of her life. This calculator is a great first step that women can do on their own and discuss the results with their primary care doctor or gynecologist, says Dr. Jennifer Litton, professor of breast medical oncology at MD Anderson Cancer Center. The tool was built using data from the Breast Cancer Demonstration Project, a 1970 study of 280,000 white women and the NCI Surveillance, Epidemiology, and End Results Program. Data from Black, Hispanic, and Asian women were added later to provide more accurate predictions for women of different races and ethnicities. While it's still less accurate for women of color, research has found that the tool is about 98% accurate in predicting disease risk. It's especially helpful for those who have a family history of breast cancer, people who don't know their genetic risk for the disease, and those who don't have major genes for breast cancer such as BRCA1 or BRCA2, which was the case for Munn. About 500,000 women use it annually, according to NCI, and after Munn's post, the Breast Cancer Risk Assessment Tool received a dramatic increase in visits, a spokesperson said. Some doctors use the questionnaire in conjunction with a slightly more comprehensive one called the Tyrer-Cuzick model, which is also free and available online. Together with regular mammograms starting around age 40, these risk assessments help doctors decide which women should get mammograms more frequently and whether they need additional tests like an MRI. Knowing a woman's risk score can lead to early detection of cancer, as it did for Munn. Yet many women aren't aware that there's a short risk quiz they can take, then discuss with their doctors. Knowledge is power, says Dr. Larry Norton, medical director of the Evelyn H. Lauder Breast Center at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. The more you know about yourself and the more you engage with medical professionals, the better you can get answers that are appropriate for you. And now the D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent for Time magazine. When the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, Kelly Robinson was running the political shop at Planned Parenthood. Like many abortion rights advocates, she'd seen the moment looming. Still, it felt like a personal and professional thwacking. Up until Roe was overturned, even after the leak that they planned to overturn Roe came out, we polled folks across the country, and they still did not believe it was true, she says. They just would not believe that the Supreme Court in our lifetime would actually overturn such a fundamental right that had been the law of the land for over 40 years. Robinson is now president of the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest LGBTQ civil rights organization, and she fears she's watching the same slow-moving car crash all over again. Before 2015, marriage rights varied by state. With Obergefell versus Hodges, the court extended the federal right to marry to same-sex couples. It was a reflection of how views of same-sex relationships had shifted and would continue to. But while polls have moved one way, the composition of the court has shifted to the other. If Roe could fall after 49 years, there's no reason to think Obergefell is safer after less than a decade in effect. The legal breadcrumbs are not difficult to find. Justice Samuel Alito, in particular, has been sprinkling swipes at Obergefell in concurrences and dissents since 2020. And then there are the smattering of cases, mostly to do with trans rights, working their way through courts in red states. Any one of those reaching the nation's highest court could give the conservative majority a chance to undermine Obergefell or wipe it out entirely, and with it, later rulings and rules that cite it as precedent. If the red-blue divide that emerged for abortion rights is any guide, Americans would likely see a similar geographical split on access to same-sex marriage and other anti-discrimination rules that rely on rights promulgated by Obergefell. The ripple effects would be massive and, for millions, heart-wrenching. It's why Robinson is among those pushing Democrats to make the case for LGBTQ rights are on the ballot just as much as abortion. This isn't just some sort of fantasy. This could actually be our reality unless we do something, she says. It's why 2024 matters so much. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. Bolsonaro and Trump apart yet together. A president facing a tough fight for re-election warns his followers that corrupt elites want to steal power from them. He loses the election and calls on his supporters to defend him. Unable to block the transfer of power, he retreats to Florida. His supporters attack government buildings to protest the election result. Out of power, the former leader now faces criminal charges, the accusations that he's the one who tried to steal the last election. He remains a formidable political force, one who will shape his country's politics for years to come. This is the story of Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro. There is one crucial difference between Bolsonaro's current position and that of former President Donald Trump. Courts in Brazil have ruled that his accusations that the country's voting machines were used to rig the election against him, disqualifying Bolsonaro from running for office for 8 years, while Trump is presumptive GOP nominee. On March 1st, a former army commander reportedly told federal police that Bolsonaro was considering issuing a presidential decree to revoke the results of the election he just lost. That account aligns with claims made by other former officials. Bolsonaro denies these charges. His approval rating stands at 43%, up 10 points since he left office, and 38% of respondents tell pollsters the election was stolen from him. On February 25th, Bolsonaro held a peaceful rally at Sao Paulo, attended by an estimated 600,000 to 750,000 people. Major opposition leaders support Bolsonaro's message that he's a victim of persecution. Unlike Trump, Bolsonaro has avoided criticizing courts and judges. Bolsonaro can't seek office again until at least 2030. But even if he ends up behind bars for some time, he will be the principal kingmaker for the opposition to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's government for the foreseeable future. His supporters, like those attached to Trump and other charismatic populists, won't easily be moved by further accusations against their hero. In years ahead, more populists will fuel election campaigns not on resentment of elite politicians, but on charges of conspiracy against those who would fight for the common people and a deep distrust of political institutions. The number of people who get their news from sources that algorithmically feed their biases will continue to grow. Authoritarian governments like those in China, Russia, and Iran will use digital weapons to exploit the divisions in Western democracies. But the next major test of this strategy of populist defiance will come on November 5th, when more than 150 million Americans cast votes on the rematch between President Joe Biden and the man who says Biden stole the last election from him and the American people. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Patsy with Time Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.